3, since it has the shortest sign-up list. Gina Skinner, I understand you're here to present this bill. It'll come up. And in an effort to redeem the time, since there are a lot of people that have signed up, we're going to try to keep our testimony to shorter, 3 to 5 minutes max. But the presenters of the bills will have a little bit more latitude, since we expect them to explain it to us.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County, and I prosecute primarily domestic violence crimes. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association this morning. This is a very short bill. I don't expect that there'll be any financial implications from this bill, and basically what we are asking is there be a separate statute that allows prosecutors, when charging people with domestic violence crimes, to add those words constituting domestic violence as an element of the crime. And the term domestic violence is already defined in the statute under 135.230, and so that already exists. And we would be taking an existing definition of domestic violence and just adding it as an element to crimes where it applied. There are several reasons for this. There are several other statutes that require a crime that in the past someone's already been convicted of. If they've been convicted of a crime that constitutes domestic violence, therefore it would do something else to a new crime. It's impossible right now, basically, for prosecutors when they're charging another crime to be able to go back and to know whether a past crime constituted domestic violence or not. There are many other states where they have separate statutes for it, like domestic assault and domestic menacing. In Oregon, we do not. We use all the same statutes, whether it's domestic-related or it's not. For example, in 163-160, which is the assault force statute, in past legislatures, we've added the section that if you have three prior domestic violence assaults under any victim, with any victim, then the fourth one is a felony. Well, there's no way to know if those past three ones were, in fact, domestic violence or not, unless it was an element that was pled and proven in the charge, and the judgment says so. Also, under 133.310, subsection 6 A and B, it talks about mandatory arrest for release agreement violations for police officers. They are required under law, they're mandated to arrest if a offender violates a release agreement when they are out on a domestic violence offense. Again, it would be good to know if it was on the information that in fact it was domestic violence. The last legislature we passed, 167.320, subsection 4, subsection A, which is animal abuse in the first degree. Again, there is a way that you can prove the new crime of animal abuse in the first degree if, in fact, the person in the past has been convicted of a crime constituting domestic violence. All those statutes would be much, much easier if the prosecutors knew by looking at a judgment that, in fact, that was already a conviction that constituted domestic violence. Also in the last legislature, we passed an evidence section, Oregon evidence section 609, subsection 2, where it talks about impeachment. If someone is being charged with a domestic violence offense and they have been charged with a domestic violence offense in the past, that can be used to impeach their testimony when they're testifying. And again, there's no way to know that that particular assault for that particular harassment and that particular menacing is domestic unless it is in the judgment. Those are all some basic things that we would like to know. I think also for the federal prosecutors that are prosecuting gun laws, it wouldn't necessarily, the definition for domestic in Oregon and under federal law, which is under an intimate partner, is slightly different, but it would definitely give them the heads up that they should be looking at this case more seriously. Again, if there was a conviction for assault for, and then in the future they had a gun, I think the federal prosecutors would be much more likely to review that case more seriously, knowing that the state has already pled and proven under state law that, again, the element of domestic violence was part of the crime.
All right. Senator Farrelly, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really interested in a concept because I think prosecutors end up having to walk a very fine line between their role and responsibility in upholding the constitutional rights of the accused as well as their role in protecting the community from offenders. And so I guess I'd like to hear the witness talk about the presumption of innocence and how this change in the law would affect the presumption of innocence of a defendant who is charged with a case where you would, in the impeachment of the witness through cross-examination or by even charging the crime, balance the issue of presumption of innocence of the accused rights with the duty to protect the community. How does it work?
Well, the statute that talks about the impeachment of offenders, that's already currently state law. And so all this would be doing would be, instead of the state in an effort to impeach the defendant in that particular scenario, we would either have to get the defendant to stipulate that the prior conviction was domestic, or as part of the trial, we would have to present evidence about a past event in order to get that piece of it to be able to prove to the judge that as part of this impeachment that past event was domestic, whereas if it was pled and proven beyond a reasonable doubt in a prior occasion and then it met all the requirements for the impeachment currently under law, that element already existed, and so we wouldn't have to go into any factual questioning of that prior event. I don't know if that even comes close to answering the question.
Mr. Chairman, I follow up if I might.
Yes, of course.
I'm just trying to get the finer point here, and
okay.
For a layperson, it sometimes takes a hop for me. But in a trial that stipulates some kind of a prior conviction, a prior case, under current statute, you're allowed to refer to that case and bring that evidence before the jury if it was for a domestic violence under current statute.
Chairman and Senator Farioli, there are two circumstances in a domestic assault case where that would be the case. Under 163-160, which is the domestic assault statute, there are several different ways where prior convictions, whether it's once against the same partner or three times against any partner, and it constitutes domestic violence, that's an element of the charge and it rises the penalty to a felony. That would be addressed as far as the fact that conviction is on that person's record. As far as talking about the evidence, section 609, subsection 2, there is a section that if the defendant testifies in a domestic case and in that subsection, it lists the kinds of cases where that would apply, that certain prior domestic convictions would be allowed, but for the purposes of impeachment only, on the defendant's testimony, only if he chose to testify.
And maybe for the purpose of enlightenment, tell us how that happens currently, since we don't, if I understand correctly, we do not have a domestic violence charge. I mean, we've got domestic violence assault, but
that's right.
Assault is a standalone, and we have the compulsory arrest statute.
Chairman, it is very cumbersome, as a matter of fact, which is why we wanted to pass the statute. The of the five statutes I mentioned, that one specifically with impeachment is very cumbersome because the prior must have, the partners must have been in a domestic violence relationship in order for that conviction to be impeachable. So if the defendant won't stipulate to that fact, then we would have to have a hearing before the trial and try to...
Is that hearing before the jury or before the judge?
No, that would be in front of a judge, Your Honor, in order to establish that fact. I guess it would be really left up to a judge to make the determination if they wanted to hear it in front of a jury or in front of the judge. Most commonly, it would be in front of the judge alone. But we would have to then try to bring in the prior victim to come in and testify when this case may be 4 or 5 years old. I did have that happen once in the 163-160 subsection where it talks about three prior domestic assault convictions, then the next one becomes a felony. I'm having a grand jury where I had 20 witnesses because I had to bring in all these people from all these prior assaults to be able to show that the new one was a felony.
Does that make sense to you?
It does, but I guess the question still is that I understand when the impeachment of testimony against the defendant could be used, and that's when they are called as a witness in their own cases. But normally, because there's a recognition that kind of impeachment can predispose the jury to a conclusion about the person, about the defendant, that would enter into the question whether to place the defendant on the witness stand or not. And we do protect other witnesses from that kind of impeachment. For instance, in rape cases or other sexual assault cases, the sexual history of the victim is not admissible in court, is because it's an impeachment of the credibility of the witness. And I'm just wondering if you feel that there's anything in this kind of impeachment that predisposes the jury to a conclusion about the defendant. I'm interested in whether or not you think you can adequately protect the constitutional rights of defendants, because that's also part of the prosecutor's role.
Chairman and Senator Farrelly, I don't know if this particular statute is going to affect the concerns that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I testified in the last legislature regarding that evidence section when it was passed into law. There was a lot of testimony provided at that time that talked about what other crimes are allowed in to impeach defendants that are equally, can be inferred equally from a jury as far as their opinion of the truthfulness of the defendant, which is the only reason that it would be allowed into testimony. An instruction is under case law, if the defense requested it, is required to be given to the jury about how they can consider that evidence. The actual law of whether or not this would become impeachable against a defendant if he testifies at trial is not an issue here today,
mm-hmm.
Because that's already law. The only issue that we have here today is whether or not if the state, beyond a reasonable doubt, pleads and proves an additional element that shows the relationship of the parties and the nature of the underlying charge, then under Oregon law, as it's already defined under 132 to 230, that it would, under 135 to 230, that this crime that we're now pled and proved and convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, that charge would be also include the element of constituting domestic violence, so that in future cases under current law, that it would be that the state could more, not easily, because we could still get that evidence, it just makes it so that other victims don't have to come in and testify at a new trial, or that other evidence wouldn't be coming in, that we would all be on the same page that this person has already been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of this crime.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I get it. I mean,
we're talking two different issues, right? This bill is...
Let me try to bring this to closure. I guess what I see is that during the sentencing phase, if the case was proven for domestic violence, then certainly that ought to be amended into the charge. But I guess I just don't see how you can avoid prejudice in juries when you bring a charge that stipulates domestic violence, which had to be proven in previous cases. Yeah. Maybe it's too far afield.
Chairman and Senator Farrelly, I think what you just touched on there is a different issue, and I don't know if your concern is then prejudicing a jury where you've got a new crime that's being presented to them, and one of the elements that they have to prove is domestic violence. I can assure you that in every crime that I've prosecuted, that is in case the fact the jury knows that that's the case. I mean, we talk about it for voir dire for probably an hour, talking about people's prejudice against domestic violence. So it's not a secret to anyone in the jury that's listening to the new case that the current case is constituting domestic violence. It would just that under current law, there's no, whether it's at pleading or at sentencing, there's no provision that allows for that to be part of the judgment.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Any other questions from the committee? There are none. Thank you, Gina.
Thank you.
Let me see. We've got a few folks here. Ann Christian, you're neutral on this from the Judicial Department. So you probably have cheery news for us, right? This is going to cost a fortune? No.
I do not.
All right. Oh, it won't cost a fortune. Good. Good.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I'm employed with the Judicial Department, and I'm here to present written testimony to you today on Senate Bill 303. I'm here in the context of Oregon Judicial Department court operations as opposed to indigent defense. And as you stated, Mr. Chair, the Judicial Department takes no position on the bill, but we have two issues for you to consider. You mentioned fiscal impact. When we first reviewed this bill, we had a concern that there would, in fact, be a fiscal impact as a result of this bill. And in talking briefly, and I did not personally talk with Mr. Penn, but one of our staff talked with Mr. Penn. This is a bill that's been introduced at the request of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And talking with Mr. Penn to determine the intent of the bill. One of the biggest issues the Judicial Department had is whether or not the bill would require any changes to the Oregon Judicial Information Network, which is the register of actions, and more particularly, Mr. Chair, whether or not there would be an expectation that the Judicial Department would be reporting dispositions in cases where domestic violence is pled and proven at trial as an element of the crime. Specifically, whether or not that information would be expected to be transmitted from the Judicial Department to the law enforcement data system, to LEDS. And we, our fiscal impact does indicate that there would be an indeterminate but minimal impact, and we put that on the fiscal impact based on the assumption that the bill itself does not require the department's electronic criminal disposition reporting system to send that data to LEDS. As Ms. Skinner just testified, the Judicial Department would be in a position where the district attorneys do plead and prove domestic violence as an element of the crime, to have the judgment in the case indicate that it was a domestic violence conviction. But as far as reporting purposes, and I'm not the expert, Mr. Chair, as far as the OGIN system and electronic reporting, but I understand that both the state police and the Judicial Department, if the expectation would be that criminal histories, for example, would show a conviction with one of these elements as a domestic violence conviction, that that would entail reprogramming and a rather significant fiscal. So because the bill does not in and of itself indicate that the expectation is that that criminal disposition information will be reported as a domestic violence conviction, then we are taking the position that the fiscal is minimal.
All right.
I'd be happy to answer questions which you may have.
Actually, I have none that wouldn't cause the entire thing to spiral out of control. So I'm not going to get into computers and databases and all that kind of stuff. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Other questions? All right. Lee Anderson.
May I refer, Mr. Chairman, to Dennis Stein?
Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Of course. Does that mean you do not want to testify, or you want to testify after Debbie Stein?
She's the legal wizard, so I just assume have her.
Okay, so you're not going to testify, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Ma'am.
Good morning. I'm here as I'm an attorney in Salem, Oregon. I'm mainly criminal defense attorney. However, I've also represented people from either defending on a restraining order or someone who's filing a restraining order. I also represent women and men and people who are victims of crimes. I'm also part of the Women Empowered for Defense seminars, which is empowering women to be able to do something that protects themselves. And I also am here as someone who has been a victim of domestic abuse from a husband, and speak out upon that and have my own program talking about going from victim to survivor to thriver. So with that background, I'm speaking on these bills against them. One of my concerns is that the temporary restraining orders, to put this in there where it takes away the guns, is a false protection. Again, with the restraining...
What bill are you testifying on?
All three.
Really? Okay.
Yes. They take it away, as first of all, as a false protection to the women. It's like saying once you have the restraining order and supposedly we've taken away the guns, that you're going to be safe. It's also not practical to how you're going to find these guns. Like my ex, the guns he had were not registered to him. There would not have been any way to be able to find them. And the other point is, how are you going to store them, and just the administrative part of this. The restraining order is a tool that's used after domestic violence, and it's only as good as you can use it as far as reporting violations, and a woman has to take the responsibility for her own safety. The other concern is that the restraining orders have a very low standard. We're not talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt when you get into one of these situations. I've had a situation where I was helping the person on the hearing defending when they had been charged with a restraining order, and the judge said, yeah, it doesn't quite meet the standard for the restraining order, however, I'm going to grant it because I think you two need to stay away from each other.
Ms. Stein, help me understand. What does this bill have to do with restraining order? 303.
The bill's about having...
The bill, 303, what does it have to do with...
I was talking about on all three bills.
Oh, no, we're
49.
No, we're constraining this to 303. I need to know what your objection is to 303, because you signed up against it.
Okay. On 303, which is on the domestic violence elements, having to do with that, is, from the way this sounds that it's been written, is that any... they can add it to any crime. So in other words, if you had a trespass, if you had criminal mischief, if you have a disorderly, if you had a harassment, and some of these are very low-level crimes. Harassment, if I came up to you and poked you in the shoulder and you found that offensive, that could be harassment. And then if there was any type of intimate partner with that situation, then that would itself be domestic violence. So as far as a 303, that is overbroad to add it on to any crime.
All right. And do you have suggestions for how you would change that, how you would constrain it?
I don't think it can be. I just think it's overbroad. And the realities here, when you put law like this, is we think that the law is applied evenly. But I can tell you as a defense attorney, if you name the county, you name the prosecutor, name the judge, the result is going to be different.
All right. You're a defense attorney?
Yes, I am.
What do you think you would have to do as a matter of course during a trial to disprove this element? I'm assuming the prosecutor has to prove it. You have to somehow refute that. How would you do that?
Obviously, you take whatever they're presenting, and you'd have to refute it for either if there was any witnesses in the credibility.
So you try to impeach the testimony of the witnesses.
Yes, which is also, if you're dealing with a victim type of situation, that's a very delicate situation to be able to have to do that.
Any other questions? All right. Ms. Stein, I'll have you stand down for now. And sorry to have to go through this, but I have to maintain some order in my own head here. All right. Lee, one last chance. You want to talk on 303 or not?
Not on 303, thank you.
All right, good. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 303. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 300. We'll start with 300. I think at this time, what we're going to do is we're going to do 300, and we'll get Sybil, who's the proponent of this bill, up. And then I think to redeem the time for Ms. Nato, Commissioner Nato, we'll do a brief public hearing on that so we can get her testimony on the record so she can go if she needs to go. Other more important county business. All right. So, Sybil, we're in a public hearing. Senate Bill 300.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm an attorney at the Oregon Law Center in Portland. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 300 on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. The Alliance is a statewide group of advocates for survivors of domestic violence and of sexual assault. The Alliance has proposed Senate Bill 300 to enhance the safety of survivors by getting the guns out of hands of batterers who are subject to certain restraining orders. Senate Bill 300 does not propose to make any changes, though, to Oregon's gun laws, nor does it propose to make any substantive changes to the current restraining order laws in Oregon. Rather, the bill would amend Oregon restraining order procedures in two ways so that Oregon's orders would more clearly provide petitioners with the protections of current federal laws, which already exist and make it a felony to possess a firearm or ammunition while subject to certain protective orders. The problem is that Oregon's restraining order laws currently do not qualify, some of them do not qualify for federal protection because of a glitch in our procedures. Even those orders which do trigger federal liability are hard to identify because of the lack of a statewide consistent form that's used after contested hearings. Therefore, because they're harder to identify, they're harder to enforce. Senate Bill 300 is designed to correct these problems. In order for federal gun laws to apply to a state restraining order, there are several requirements that must be met. One of the handouts that you've been given addresses what the specific requirements are for federal law to apply. You can see from the handout, and I won't address the orders, the types of requirements that Oregon law already satisfies, but there are two requirements that go sometimes unmet in Oregon law, in Oregon restraining orders. The first is that in order for federal law to apply, the order, the restraining order, must protect the respondent's intimate partner, as that term is defined by federal law. That term is defined to mean the respondent's current or former spouse, or current and or former cohabitant, or the other parent of the respondent's child. As many of you know, in Oregon, restraining orders are available to a broader class of people,
as defined by ORS 107705. In Oregon, family or household members may qualify for a restraining order, and that term is broader, would include, for example, adults who are related by blood or by marriage, or sexual intimates within the past 2 years. Those two categories of people who would qualify for an Oregon restraining order would not qualify for the protection of federal law because they would not be intimate partners as defined and required by federal law. The second requirement that must be met in order for federal law to be triggered is that there must have been a noticed hearing for the respondent at which the respondent was given an opportunity to be heard. In Oregon, as many of you know, restraining orders are issued on an ex parte basis initially, and the respondent is typically not present at that hearing. A hearing is only held at the respondent's request in Oregon currently. A petitioner does not have any current authority or ability explicitly to request that a noticed hearing be set. Thus, the respondent, who is the alleged batterer, is in the position of controlling whether or not the protective order may qualify for the federal protection. A respondent who wishes to avoid federal liability may simply choose not to request a hearing and therefore fall out of the protection of federal law or the liability of federal law. The solution proposed by Senate Bill 300 is twofold. One is that it would allow the petitioner, in addition to the current authority for the respondent to request a noticed hearing to be set. The bill would allow a petitioner who then feels particularly at risk of firearm violence to seek the protection of federal law. We don't expect that many petitioners will avail themselves of this opportunity because many would prefer we suppose, to forego the risk of having a hearing, or some may prefer simply not to want to take the step because they don't feel like they'd be at risk of firearm violence. But for the select few for whom firearm violence is a great risk, this amendment would provide petitioners with the choice to decide whether or not they'd like their order to qualify for federal protection. In addition, Senate Bill 300 would also create a way to identify which orders are orders that trigger the protection of federal law. There's currently no statewide form in use in identifying which orders impose federal gun liability. Frequently, restraining orders that are upheld after a hearing contain no information regarding the parties' relationships or the specific terms of the order. This means that law enforcement, prosecutors, the parties, and others often cannot tell from the face of the order whether or not it is one that triggers federal liability. As a consequence, most Oregon restraining orders are not recognized as federally qualifying orders, even though they may in fact impose that liability for gun dispossession. Senate Bill 300 would propose to address this problem by providing a one-page uniform form for courts to use after a contested hearing to certify whether or not compliance has been met with the requirements of the federal law. The use of this certificate would make qualifying orders easier to track, to identify, to record, and thus to enforce. In summary, the passage of this bill would not interfere with the rights of law-abiding citizens to own or use guns. It would not affect the respondent's right to a due process of law. The bill would simply close a loophole that currently exists in the enforcement and implementation of current federal laws. In Oregon, we've had ample opportunity to recognize that guns and domestic violence are a lethal combination. Senate Bill 300 would allow petitioners the choice to seek the protection of federal law, and it would make the federally qualifying orders easier to track. I urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
All right. Any questions of Sybil? Senator Burdick.
Just to clarify, this would not broaden the number of people who would be subject to the federal law. For example, you mentioned that in Oregon, a bigger class of people can get restraining orders. This would not allow that bigger class to invoke the federal.
That's correct, Senator Burdick. The only thing this would do would clarify which underlying relationships exist so that people would know whether or not their order, their relationship, and therefore their order was one that triggered the federal law protection or liability.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. What is the length of time these restraining orders might typically be in effect? Are they short-term or are they permanent?
Restraining orders in Oregon are issued for a period of 1 year,
And there's the ability to renew based on certain circumstances. So they may be extended, but the typical restraining order, it lasts for a year from the date of issuance. And it's important to recognize, I didn't note earlier, but the prohibition applied, the federal prohibition against gun possession only applies during the existence of the order. It would expire when the order itself expires. Another thing to note is that the federal law provides for a public use exception so that law enforcement officers or members of the military, those for whom there is a public use required for their guns, would not be subject to gun dispossession under the federal law for having a restraining order against them.
Are you finished, Senator Reagan? All right, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That prompts a question for me. That last comment that you made, even if a public safety officer has been accused of domestic violence with a weapon, they would still be able to carry their weapon?
The federal law applies does not apply to people who have a public use authority for their weapon. The federal law doesn't make it illegal for them to use guns, even if they're subject to a restraining order. However, that would only be an exception that would allow them to use their guns within the purpose of their normal official duty. So, for example, a law enforcement officer who was subject to a qualifying protective order would have to turn his or her gun in at the end, at the close of day. It would be illegal for them federally to have the gun outside of their scope of their duty.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that clarifies that. Thank you.
Council Fritz.
Ms. Seb, I wanted to have a little bit of testimony on an issue. This bill, Symbol 300, related to ORS 107-718 sub 9, that's the one that says if the respondent fails to request a hearing within 30 days, the provisions are sufficient to meet the due process requirements of the federal law. Would you tell the committee about how this would affect that subsection 9?
Thank you, Mr. Prinz. Currently, the statute is drafted such that I wasn't involved in the process which created that subsection 9 of ORS 107718. It's my understanding that that statute was created to try to qualify Oregon orders that are continued after the ex parte process without the existence of a hearing. And it's my opinion that statute currently does not accomplish its purpose, and that, in fact, an opportunity for a hearing, an actual hearing, is required. So our amendments would just simply give the petitioner the right to make sure that hearing takes place, should she so choose.
Yes, of course.
And I want to clarify your answer. Are you saying that would require due process, or would satisfy due process requirements, or satisfy the federal regulation prohibiting?
It would simply satisfy the federal regulation, which requires that, or which imposes the liability only after a noticed hearing at which the respondent had the opportunity to be heard.
Okay. And what about due process? Is it already satisfied, in your opinion?
I believe the due process is already satisfied. Thank you.
Thank you. No further questions.
All right. Thank you very much. You can stand down unless you want to tell us something.
Thank
else.
You very much.
And then we're going to close the public hearing. 300, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 49. Commissioner Nato, I assume you're out there somewhere. There you are. Commissioner Nato and others.
Thank you. Is this mic on? Good morning.
Good morning. You're going to have to speak up.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for holding this hearing on Senate Bill 49. I'd like to just take one moment and step back and look at the larger picture of what we're talking about this morning in any of these bills. According to Multnomah County statistics, between 1976 and 1999, 61% of all domestic violence-related homicides involved firearms. In some of the cases, a restraining order was in effect, in some not. Some of the abusers were ordered to be dispossessed of their firearms, and some weren't. In all cases, the criminal justice system failed for these people. According to an Oregon Health Division report on the 1999 to 2000 intimate partner homicides, firearms were the most commonly used weapons. All male victims killed by women were killed with handguns or other short guns. Three quarters of the 27 female victims were killed with various types of firearms. In July of 2001, the issue of firearms and domestic violence made headlines once again with the tragic murder of Winnell Bernal at the hands of her husband. Winnellyn was shot to death in her car by her estranged husband as her children, seated in the car, watched. He then took the children back to his apartment, left them in the hallway, and shot himself. The family had been in court that morning for a contested restraining order hearing. Another person I wanted to bring their testimony forward today is Brad Crossfield. He is the father of Christina Getty. He wanted very much to be here this morning, but he fell ill with the flu. According to Brad, Christina would want her story to be told. On February 5, 2002, Christina Getty was shot to death by her estranged boyfriend, Jeff McCarley, with 2-year-old daughter Lily in her arms. Their 4-year-old daughter, Megan, lay next to her on the bed. Police who responded to the 911 call were reportedly very upset at the sight of children drenched in their mother's blood. Though Christina did not obtain a protective order, McCarley had previous allegations of domestic violence assaults and numerous incidents with police. He was also under investigation for sexual abuse of one of their daughters, purportedly angering him to the point of murdering Christina. At the time of the child abuse report, Christina complained that he had firearms. Entries in her journal revealed a long-standing fear of being murdered by McCarley. On the anniversary of their mother's death, the girls are still highly distraught. Brad Crossfield, now raising his 2 young granddaughters alone, is convinced that laws like this may prevent future homicides. Quote, anything that can help prevent another violent murder must be implemented, unquote. Similar intimate partner-related homicides caused by firearms in other states have resulted in similar laws to dispossess domestic violence offenders of their firearm upon issuance of a restraining order, both contested and ex parte, or if previously convicted. Hawaii, Massachusetts, Maryland, Indiana, New Jersey, New York, Texas, and New Hampshire have all restricted possession of firearms where there's a history of domestic violence. I have included for you information regarding these laws as researched recently by Linda Levitt from Lewis and Clark College. I want to take a moment to talk about this bill, Senate Bill 49. It would require dispossession of firearms upon a restraining order or a conviction of a misdemeanor involving domestic violence. Also, I believe they passed out some -2 amendments in my conversations with police associations and gun lobby. We could limit this to where the respondent requests a hearing so it falls under the contested hearing requirements to be alignment with the federal laws. I would support also Senate Bill 300 to allow the petitioner to request a hearing, and then that could be also included in this so that, it could clearly be part of an order after a hearing has been set. With me today is Lonnie Feathers, who has the miraculous good fortune to be alive to tell her own harrowing story of survival after sustaining 3, let me repeat, 3 gunshot wounds to the head, and also Steve Dole, president of Crime Victims United. You will hear their perspectives both as crime victims and survivors. Thank you again for your consideration of this critical tool to help prevent future firearms-related violence.
All right, great. Who's to go next?
My name is Lonnie Feather. 16 months ago, I was shot 3 times in the head by my former boyfriend. I pretended to be dead so he wouldn't shoot me again and waited 3 hours before I could call 911 and was then held hostage for 4 more hours before the SWAT team and paramedics could reach me. I am very fortunate to have survived, and I can only call it a miracle that I could be here today. And I can't help to think that instead of me, it may have been my daughter sitting here asking you to do everything that you can to save another woman's life. My story is just one story. A person I knew tried to kill me with a gun. And the untold effect that it has had on my life and my family's is immeasurably tragic. We will carry the scars forever. Unfortunately, there are many others who have become victims of domestic abuse and gun violence. A woman is battered every 9 seconds in the United States. One out of four women have been assaulted by an intimate partner. And most murders of intimate partners are committed with a firearm, 62%. I am here today to remind you that this happens, that it is real, that domestic abuse can be lethal, especially when guns are involved, and something has to happen to make this change. I don't know if this bill would have prevented me from being shot, but what I do know is that if even one woman is saved from a gun death, it's worth it, and her family will thank you. And I do believe that we can eliminate this appalling epidemic. Our justice departments can do a great deal by imposing stiffer penalties and by keeping dangerous offenders in jail. And our elected officials can aggressively support and fund programs that support victims and help the abusers. But I'm here today to ask you to specifically support Senate Bill 49. It is only right. We must do everything that we can, wherever we can, to change the tide of violence. So please, protect the innocent, protect the children, and protect the women. Please save lives and get the guns out of the hands of batterers. Thank you.
All right. Senator Walker has a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Feather, I'm pleased that you're here with us today.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry you had to go through that. I'd like to just ask you, was your former boyfriend, had you reported him for domestic violence in the past, and was he under any kind of restraining order, or was this something just out of the blue?
Out of the blue, yeah. I did not file a restraining order against him. He was not violent against me.
He had never been violent against you prior
Correct.
To this time?
Correct.
So, unfortunately, this bill wouldn't impact situations such as yours.
Yes.
But I think that's probably the more unusual circumstance.
I think it is, very much so.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to ask you just a quick question, too. You say that this was out of the blue in your particular circumstance. Did you have any idea or clue that this relationship was leading towards some potential violence?
No, I did not.
None whatsoever?
None whatsoever.
Okay. And by the way, this is not just a Women's Protection Act, because Stephen Moskowitz, an attorney in Portland, was shot 9 times by his ex-wife, and he survived, too. He's practicing law today. Okay. Senator Brady.
Thank you, and thank you for coming today. Just for the record, are you also supporting Senate Bill 300, or are you here just specifically on 49?
Specifically for 49, yes.
Okay. Is there a difference in the bills that makes you prefer 49 over 300?
No. I'm here to support anything that will protect lives.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. We've finished with questions. Go to Mr. Dole.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Thank you for considering this important legislation. Crime Victims United continues to support law enforcement by giving them all of the tools necessary not only to apprehend and prosecute violent criminals, but also to help prevent these violent crimes from occurring in the first place. Lonnie Feathers is but one example of how ordinary citizens are unwillingly recruited into de facto membership of our organization in the most cruel and excruciating manner. To have survived the horrendous violence perpetrated upon her and now stand before you is a testament to her fortitude and her courage. To use her experience to further the cause of ending violence by those who would use a gun is the very essence of being a survivor. Though my daughter Lisa's murderer used a car as his weapon, the particular instrument of the crime matters little to those who survive. My pain in losing my daughter is identical to that experienced by the story you heard from Lisa Nato of Brad Crossfield, Christina Getty's father. We are chance members of a macabre club forever, parents of murdered children, who seek to limit future membership. When homicides are caused using vehicles as weapons, remedies are sought to restrict licensing procedures and prevent vehicular homicides. When the instrument of the crime happens to be a firearm, similar restrictions must be implemented. Method matters not, only that the law-abiding citizens are guaranteed the reasonable expectation that law enforcement will have the tools necessary for preventing violent crime. And I might also add that the law-abiding citizens who have own guns, that their rights are also protected. This legislation is a common-sense approach to resolving a flaw with our laws regarding access to firearms. When a person has demonstrated to a judge that they are in fear of imminent harm, they have a right to know that the person they fear will not be allowed to possess a firearm until such time that it is determined to be safe. If a person has been convicted of a previous domestic violence assault, it is reasonable to assume that that person may not lawfully possess a firearm. Crime Victims United urges your support of Senate Bill 49, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions of Senator Reno, excuse me,
something like that. Thanks for coming.
The Honorable Senator.
Don't get carried away, Mr. Chair. thanks for coming, Tessa. I'm sure that I will vote for all three bills, and I appreciate you coming here today. But, you know, the U.S. has, 11,000 gun deaths a year, and I don't think these bills are really going to make a dent in that statistic. It wouldn't have impacted your situation, Mr. Dole. It wouldn't have impacted yours. And I would just appreciate any comments on how we make a dent in 11,000 gun deaths a year, because this isn't it.
What? Are you directing that towards me?
Well, yeah, sure. I'll start with you.
Well, I might, Chairman, members of the committee, I might say this, that because I think that Senator Burdick had this question, Ms. Feather, I also support Senate Bill 300. I am a member of the Executive Committee of Project Safe Neighborhoods, which is the federal initiative by President Bush. In fact, it was his number one initiative till we were struck with 9/11 and the terrorist situation, to enforce all of the gun laws that we have in the United States that are on the books and get after felons in possession, gang gun violence, juveniles who use guns in the commission of crimes, and domestic violence. And I firmly believe that if we enforce the laws that are on our books, and Senate Bill 300 will allow the feds to get into this, which they can't now, that if we enforce those laws and go after the felons in possession without continually trying to create new laws around the issue of firearms, that we will reduce the amount of deaths. And I think that by enforcing those laws and making sure that our state laws that put away people who are felons in possession or that use guns in the commission of violence, and I'm talking about enhanced sentences for people who use guns in assault, in a murder, in a kidnapping, in a rape, whatever, are the answers to reducing those numbers.
Thank you.
All right.
I might briefly respond to that as well. I'm also working with the U.S. Attorney, Michael Mossman, on Project Safe Neighborhoods. I think that what these laws can do is give uniformity to who is entitled, clearly, to allow some certainty for the police when they make a stop to know somebody is dispossessed of their firearm, or to allow them to make a search if then they believe firearms are on the premises. We have had discussions with our sheriff, who is willing to look at how these firearms might be stored pending the restraining order, for instance, when the judge orders that. Ultimately, it isn't going to, you know, save every life, but I think education out there for a person who is subject to a restraining order to know that they're clearly dispossessed of their guns, to provide for storage of those pending the resolution of the case, time when angers can be flared and it's the recipe for disaster at that time when things are really going bad between in a family. I think the education piece is just really critical so that they know they shouldn't have the guns. And most of these laws are providing clarity and certainty so we could go under federal prosecutions as well.
Thank you.
Obviously, it's not the only answer, but I think they do add up to a significant step forward. I've also submitted testimony from Mike Shankar, District Attorney, on your behalf.
Okay. know that I saw that, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Continue on then. And actually, Steve, on Senate Bill 300, do you have different testimony?
I don't. I just, since you've closed the hearing and
I'm going to cross you off on 300, and you can always come back if you feel like you need to say something. At this point, then, trying to remember what bill we're on. Thank you very much. I'm losing my own place here. I'm sorry. Yeah, we can do that. Or I can continue to confuse myself, whichever. I want to bring up Kamala Sugar, however you pronounce that. And what I'm going to ask you to do is not read testimony. If you've got some significant differences or some things that you'd like to make points of, let's just quickly move through that. I want to give the people that want to beat this thing up an opportunity to do their thing.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Minnis. My name is Kamala Sugar. I'm an assistant DA from Lane County. And I would like to just touch on a few points that were raised, and I won't reiterate what was already said. With regard to Senate Bill 49, I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I would like to echo that it does allow for police officers to have authority to seize weapons when a person has one of these situations, whether they're either a prior conviction for a domestic assault or they are subject to a restraining order. Currently, we don't have federal law enforcement officers patrolling our neighborhoods, and we don't have the protection unless we give that to our local law enforcement officers. I would also note that with regard to the restraining orders, in most circumstances, aside from the one addressed in Senate Bill 300, the respondent in a restraining order is already subject to federal law, and we're bringing Oregon law in conformance with that. We'd ask that the committee also consider that one of the concerns raised was whether a law enforcement officer or military personnel would be prohibited from possessing a firearm. And I'll just give you the code section for the United States Code. It's 18 U.S.C. Section 925, and that does allow an exception for a law enforcement officer or military personnel while they're in the course of official duty. And that would be in effect for Senate Bill 300, however, not in effect for Senate Bill 49 currently, unless that was codified into Oregon law. So I wanted to give you that section in case you chose to consider that.
All right, Senator Burdick.
Just for my edification, what about 49 does that 300 doesn't? Why is that?
Senate Bill 300, these bills could work together, but currently they don't. Senate Bill 300 basically just simply allows the petitioner to request a hearing, therefore kicking federal law into place. So that section would apply because that's applying federal law. Senate Bill 49 takes what could be Oregon law, what is basically federal law, and tries to make it also Oregon law. So in Oregon, it would be unlawful to possess a firearm under those two circumstances, if you've been convicted of the assault or if you're the subject of a restraining order. Should Senate Bill 300 pass, then the amendment proposed, I received a copy of this morning, I'm assuming it's before the committee, the amendment proposed probably needs to be changed a little bit to say continued after a hearing is requested, so it could be requested by either party in 49. With regard to how this exception would apply to 49, it doesn't, and it would have to be added, it should have to be added underneath, I think it's G, in Senate Bill 49, where it indicates a restraining order is in effect.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I still don't understand why police officers would be more restricted under 49 than they would under 300.
Chairman and Senator Burdick, there isn't the exception under Oregon law with 49.
In other words, you would have to dispossess weapons from police officers and or military individuals under 49, whereas under 300, it includes the exception, correct?
Unless you codified.
Right, unless we change it.
Right.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. I wanted to say one other thing, if I might. This bill may not have, there were some concerns raised that this bill may not have protected someone like Lonnie Feathers in her situation. What it would do, however, is it would protect the next girlfriend of her abuser, because it would have made that person convicted of an assault, and it would be a domestic assault. And so the next girlfriend would be protected because that person would not be allowed to own a firearm. And I would like to say that I was having a conversation regarding this bill with a defense attorney from my county, and his comment was, "Boy, we dispossessed theft in the first degree convicted people, felons who just stolen something worth more than $750. We dispossess them of firearms because they're felons. But someone who is actually physically violent with another person and shows a propensity for that violence in a domestic situation is allowed to walk around with a firearm." And I think that that's something worth considering, that we've got nonviolent people who are dispossessed of firearms. We have people who are proven to be violent who aren't. Okay, that's all that I have.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Senator Ring.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying. I want to focus for a little bit on the 11,000 gun deaths in America. Steve Dole said we need to enforce the laws on the books. You're a district attorney. How do you evaluate that?
Chairman, is Senator Ringo, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, he said enforce those gun laws on the books. That's what we need to do. So I want to know, is that the answer?
I believe that in order to better enforce the laws that are on the books, we need to pass Senate Bill 300.
Yes, but I'm asking a little broader question.
Okay.
Okay. Are there gun laws on the books that are not being enforced as far as you're concerned?
Not on my team that I supervise with six lawyers, but I can't speak for everyone in the state of the country.
Okay. I mean, I just want to understand the larger problem. And you're not able to say that we have gun laws on the books that we're failing to enforce.
I'm not.
All right, okay. Thank you.
I would like to say, though, that without the protection of 300 and without the enhanced supervision that and protection that law enforcement officers would have with 49, we could be doing more.
Thank you.
And
thank
Ms. Sugar,
yes.
In your practice as a prosecutor, do you oftentimes run into the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Oregon?
Of course.
Prohibitions on search and seizure, other kinds of things relevant to property rights. And
from time to time, sir.
Yeah, personal property and residences.
Those inconvenient rights.
Yeah, and I guess, and Senator Ring, I guess an argument, I know we don't get into this too deeply, but I think you really have a real, barrier, but it's in some cases a good barrier, and that's the Constitution. I mean, certainly you could have the law enforcement just simply search every person's house who happens to be involved in a domestic violence scenario and dispossess all of the weapons, et cetera, but you rise up against certain seizure issues and probable cause and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so you have some balancing tests here. We had a Supreme Court justice from Oregon sit in this committee in 2001 who said, in essence, that if we went back to what the founding fathers of the Oregon Constitution had envisioned with respect to possession of firearms, that firearms open at your side, on your hip, throughout Oregon, is clearly constitutional. Now, that was one Supreme Court justice, but he happens to have a little bit of clout, and it's based on their analysis of how they do these things. So we're treading sometimes on thin ice and some very, very dangerous and very, very tenuous waters here, if I can say that.
Well, if I may, Chair
sure.
Minnis, you're going to get a little bit of what I tell new prosecutors when I teach the domestic violence course for the ODAA, and that is that there are a lot of laws that used to exist in our state, in our country, and in the Western world, including people may be familiar with the phrase the rule of thumb. And that was the rule in 16th century England, which was that you could beat your wife with a stick no greater than the size or circumference of your thumb. Clearly, we're not interested in enforcing that law in Oregon anymore. And likewise, we didn't have the mandatory arrest law as recently as 25 years ago. And now we have the guarantee that instead of being told to take a walk around the block and cool off and come back and beat your wife some more after we leave, we have officers who are required to take someone to jail if they have probable cause an assault was committed. In Lane County, in 1993, the district attorney changed the rule for filing domestic violence crimes, and we went from prosecuting 20% to prosecuting close to 75%, because we stopped requiring victims to show up in the courthouse the day after the assault and sign a complaint against their offender. Instead, it was the prosecutor signing the complaint. So laws and have changed, and I think that we are slowly but surely making a dent in the incidence of domestic violence.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I think I've stated my preference for police beating squads and domestic violence. That has constitutional questions, too. So, all right. Let me see. Next up, if we can review this name. Mark Adams, Oregon Chiefs of Police. You're for this, so. Sorry.
Chair Menas, Senators, I'm here as, first of all, I'm Mark Adams, Chief of Police of Keyser, Oregon, and President of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm here today to testify in support of passage of Senate Bill 300. The Oregon Association Chiefs of Police have reviewed this bill, feel it's a good bill. I speak as a victim of a domestic violence, as a police officer who responds to these calls. I had the unfortunate experience of responding when there was a gun involved, and thank goodness for faulty guns, or I wouldn't be here testifying before you.
Hang on just a second. Procedurally, I'm going to submit to the wisdom of my vice chair here. I'm going to open a public hearing on both bills because I've got this thing all screwed up. Continue. Okay.
And with that, I'll just be brief. The Oregon Association Chiefs of Police supports this bill, thinks it's petitioner should have the right to call for this hearing and the chance to have weapons removed.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo, Senator Burdick.
He can go first.
Senator Burdick, Senator Ringo.
Specifically, the provision of 49 that allows confiscation of the guns, how do you feel about that provision?
Senator Burdick, I'm not familiar with that bill. I didn't review it. I'm just here on Senate Bill 300, so I really couldn't answer your question.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ringo.
You know, I just want to ask the same question I've been asking. What do we do in our society? I mean, this is a good thing. It's not the answer. What do we do?
Well, I support the right to bear arms, but
so
I think when you violate that right, then you ought to lose all rights to arms and you ought to serve a severe penalty. It should go without question in this country. You use a firearm in the commission of a crime, you're toast.
You know, Mr. Dole said that we need to enforce the laws on the books. I mean, in your experience, are there laws that we're not enforcing?
I think laws are enforced, but there's a lot of ways to avoid the penalty after the law's been enforced. You know, through the court system, there's a lot of ways to win. I also think there's some loopholes that allow people to get away with crimes involving firearms.
So, I mean, I guess I wish you'd be a little more specific. You would favor longer sentences for those who use guns in the perpetration of a crime?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, we as a society have 2 million people in jail, so that's the solution, put more people in jail.
I think that there needs to be an absolute penalty when you get a lot of trust in this country through the Second Amendment to have a firearm, and I think if you violate that, then there ought to be a severe consequence.
Okay. How about the Code of Hammurabi?
Pardon me?
Code of Hammurabi, first criminal justice code, we just whack their fingers off.
Yeah.
Then they can have a gun, but they can't use it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That has constitutional problems, too, by the way.
No.
All right. Let me see. David Niebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir.
I'm David Niebel. I'm here today representing the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. I will be very brief. I think my testimony is essentially the same as Ms. Hebb's. We support this bill. We think it's a small step, but a significant one in dispossessing batterers of firearms. I think it provides more due process for batterers, and it also empowers victims to make a choice about whether they want to invoke the protections of federal law. So with that, Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor what's already been said.
I do want to ask you a question, though. You support ending violence against women. How about violence against men?
We support ending domestic violence.
Okay, there we go. I just want to make that point
clear.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you.
Dale Penn, Your Honor. Thank you, sir.
Good morning. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. You've already had one presentation on that, and I would just briefly say that I'm personally in favor of all three bills that you have in front of you this morning. I won't add to what other people have said. I think that 349 provide practical solutions in that 49 provides a method to retain guns, and 300 provides a method to actually have the court order that a gun would not be possessed from this point forward. And so I think they fit together well, and they're necessary to provide the practical capability to restrict guns when these criteria are met: restraining orders, prior convictions. I'd simply add one thing. There's been some questions about, well, what are some factual situations where these bills would actually apply? And if the senators 2 weeks ago were looking at the Statesman Journal, you would have seen a case that fits this precisely. A young woman, Dionne Wilkes, was kidnapped in Salem and shot and murdered, and her body was found on I-5, just a few miles from here. A man, Manuel Tovar, who ultimately shot himself and his body was found a few days later, just off of I-5, had killed her as he kidnapped her and forced her to drive away south on I-5. Mr. Tovar had been a reserve police officer several years ago, had been a firearms instructor, had many firearms in his residence. He had a restraining order against him, not for Ms. Wilkes, but for his prior girlfriend. There was no mechanism to restrict guns in that situation, and Senate Bill 300 was not the law, and it really didn't apply. At any rate, Mr. Tovar, who did have a restraining order against him for another woman a few months before his relationship with Dionne Wilkes, did take a firearm, did go and break into her residence here in Salem, assault a person, kidnap her, take her down I-5, and murder her. And so it's a situation here within a few miles of the state house. The murder occurred within a few miles of the state house that illustrates the need for both Senate Bill 49 and Senate Bill 300. Be happy to answer any questions.
All right, Mr. Penn. Question, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penn, I appreciate you being here, and I have a question. I have a bill that hasn't been read yet, Senate Bill 829. And I just want to run this by you because I have a feeling we could amend or use this bill. But Senate Bill 829 requires the court to prohibit a respondent from living in the residence with unsecured firearms whenever the court includes a prohibition against possessing those firearms. So my question to you is, in the context of what we're talking about today, and the situation I would like to relate to you is that my own sister's husband took a shotgun to her head. She got a restraining order, and he was dispossessed of his firearm, but he moved next door just 500 yards, and he's living with his parents who have lots of unsecured firearms. So let me ask you, in the context of what you testified to today, mm-hmm. are you supportive of something like that, that if they're going to live in a residence, it's not their own residence, and they have a restraining order, that those firearms should be secured?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I think you've touched upon another one of these practical difficulties that come up. I have seen that same type of situation occur, and certainly the victim and the person who has the order, it doesn't feel any more safe, even though some firearms have been secured. So, yes, I support the concept. I think there are the issues, how does law enforcement actually enforce this? And that's one reason we have to have Senate Bill 49 with 300. But there might be some tinkering of 49 that we could do to help enforce 829 if that became law as well.
Okay, thank you, and I just appreciate you taking a look at that when it gets a first reading. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming. Oregon's domestic violence law applies to a bigger universe of people, potential intimate partners and people who are blood relatives, etc. Would you see any value in trying to extend the firearms ban to those people who are not currently covered under federal law?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, I do believe that Senate Bill 49 will assist in that, at least on the assault side of it, if it becomes law. But I agree that this issue of violence within family units and within relationships is a major problem. You heard statistics about maybe all the murders where people related in Lane County have been domestic violence types of murders. And nationally, people talk about 60%. And so I do think that it would be wise to try to broaden that in Oregon, because we do have large numbers of homicides in this county, at least 5 to 6 each year. And Dion Wilkes is the first one of this year, but we have this constantly. And I think having more tools for law enforcement to try to stop people from guns with these relationships from utilizing them, I think, is wise.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me see. I think I have one other person, and I've lost the sheet. There we are. Maureen McKnight, I'm assuming you're in favor of the bills. Are you in favor of the bills? Okay, come tell us what you want to tell us. And for those persons who are in the audience wishing to testify against this, we'll go to our normal time conclusion, but I'm going to bring these bills back on Wednesday, so you'll have ample opportunity to share your opinions and views. Ms. McKnight.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Maureen McKnight. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County, and I serve primarily in the Family Law Department. I'm here representing the views of that Family Law Department today, and I was testifying solely on Senate Bill 300, though I do understand they interrelate. In a nutshell, our bench is split on this bill. We have no fundamental problem at all with the goal of the proponents to remove firearms from individuals the court has found to be a danger to the physical safety of an intimate partner. And we know, and I won't repeat Judge Nato's statistics, but the county statistics are similar to federal. Our understanding of federal data in terms of how frequently firearms are present as the cause of death in a domestic homicide. The point I want to mention that I think has been addressed in passing insofar as Senate Bill 49 as it relates to 300 is that we currently lack in Oregon an effective enforcement scheme to dispossess weapons in a restraining order situation, since the violation is currently contempt and not criminal. Senate Bill 49 would help in that regard. And as I believe other witnesses have said, even if the weapons are seized currently, there's issues of law enforcement liability for storage and return of those weapons that haven't been really addressed. And it's this lack of a state scheme that makes the federal system attractive, but without repeating what Ms. Hebb said, I wanted to make some additional points, and that is, first, that the fact that there would be a contested hearing in state court that does not otherwise exist now, that is, by adding the petitioner's option for that, doesn't necessarily make the federal law applicable, because the court obviously would still have to determine that the restraining order itself should stand. So there's still that, I think, protection there. And I agree with Ms. Hebb that requesting a hearing where the respondent would be present could be risky for the petitioner, who fears losing her order when the court hears both sides of the story, or if there are issues that give her concern in terms of safety or otherwise coming to court. But similarly, requesting a hearing could be risky for a respondent who's torn between wanting different custody or parenting time terms versus not wanting to lose the right to hunt or otherwise possess a gun. So there's a lot of dynamics going on here about the choice of the hearing. And my colleagues wanted me to mention that even if the federal law were applicable because a contested hearing had been held in state court, that didn't necessarily mean that a federal prosecution would result. There's certainly a probable deterrent effect, but there haven't been a lot of prosecutions so far, though we do know that office is actively engaged in outreach now to increase those prosecutions. The major point I wanted to make was really what is of great significance to our bench is that right now we are deciding these orders hearing from only one party, because the rate of hearing requests is somewhere in the range of possibly 25% to 40% statewide right now in terms of when respondents actually request hearings to challenge the restraining order. And I think that given that lack of input, having a fuller picture of the dynamics between this couple or these family members and having the opportunity to fashion a protective order that's really best suited for the family and allows us to tailor it is really something my bench welcomes. The obvious concern in all of this is the is that of workload. There are about 14,000 restraining orders issued in this state annually. About 22% of them are issued by my county, by my bench. That works out to us, we issue about 56 orders per week, and that means about 19 or 20 of them are contested a week. If we increase that rate, and I completely defer to the State Court Administrator's Office for the details on the fiscal for statewide, in my county you're probably looking at a roughly two-hour increase of judge time. That's assuming that there is an overall increase, because, again, I agree with Ms. Hebb that there are some petitioners who won't request a hearing. Some might not prefer weapon dispossession at all. Some won't want to risk their order if they can avoid it. But there will, I think, be some petitioners who do want to request the federal law's protection, and they will request a hearing on that. I'm not certain how much of a wash there would be, because I do think some judges will not order weapon dispossession on an ex parte basis and will wait instead for a contested hearing to see if the petitioner requests a hearing or if the respondent requests one. But I don't believe that's going to be a complete wash. I think there will be some increase in hearings. And again, I defer to the state court for that those dollars. But that was what led our bench to this conflict about good policy, concerned about the fiscal, in a nutshell. Just two other points in closing. The certificate in the bill is not at all a problem. In fact, we've been doing it in Multnomah County for about 6 months, and I find that it prompts me to orally warn both the respondent of the liability and to make sure the petitioner is aware of that added protection as well. So the certificate is a very good idea. And lastly, my bench did have some amendments that we don't think changes the intent of the bill at all, but helps consolidate the notices and I think probably improves the bill overall. So having said that, I appreciate the opportunity to address you, even knowing that not having a clear position may not be all that helpful.
Had I been bright enough to figure out that you were a judge, I would have called you Judge or Your Honor, so forgive me for not. I do have a couple of questions. What kind of evidence, or how would evidence be presented in the contested cases?
Chairman and members of the committee, evidence and the contested restraining order hearings are subject to the Oregon Code of Evidence, and they're the same as any other contested trial.
So the parties appear in person?
Yes, the parties do appear in person. Occasionally, court permission is given for appearance by telephone. particularly if there are injuries that argue against a person's presence, but because the credibility is usually so important, in-person appearances are the rule.
So credibility compels in-person.
The ability, Chairman, is the ability for the trier to observe the parties is a pretty critical factor in this hearing.
But for some individual who's afraid that they might be harmed by appearing in these hearings, they can do that telephonically?
Chairman, the practice in my court has generally been to allow telephone hearings if injuries prevent the physical appearance. That is, someone is still hospitalized.
And you don't do it because they're afraid?
The safety reasons, Chairman, we believe we've been able to accommodate with various practices in terms of separation of the parties, requiring party. We have deputies in the courtroom at all times. We require the respondent to stay in the courtroom for 20 minutes after the end of the hearing so the petitioner and the petitioner's witnesses can leave. Certainly in a given case, safety could be a reason for not allowing personal appearance, but it hasn't had to be yet.
They do searches as you go in the building?
We have very rigorous web metal screening. Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. And then the passage of these bills, I'm assuming, would not grant law enforcement any additional powers to conduct searches beyond what's currently in practice.
Well, actually, Chairman, I believe Senate Bill 49, by criminalizing the possession, would address one of the loopholes now that violation of the restraining order under current law for weapon possession is contempt. And so some of the search and seizure provisions are extremely problematic in that context. But criminalizing it would address that concern.
Right, but it wouldn't give me the freedom as a detective to just wander through someone's home and search throughout the home and throughout the basement to find weapons without a search warrant, I assume.
I believe that's correct.
They're correct, okay. All right. Thank you very much, Judge Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Judge McKnight, I actually have a question for you. I understand that fiscal concerns are really important, especially since the judiciary probably got a bigger hit than any other department that is funded with general funds monies. But I have a concern. Your bench is concerned about the fiscal, and that's why they don't like Senate Bill 300. But would you agree that currently respondents are able to manipulate the restraining order process by not requesting a hearing? Would you agree that's been done now?
Chairman Senator Walker, let me first say that I don't think I'm comfortable characterizing my bench's assessment of the bill as not liking it because of the fiscal. There are several of us on the bench who would support it regardless, and several who fear the fiscal is substantial enough to be concerned about it. So we are, frankly, individually split. But having said that, in terms of your question, I don't think there's any question that some respondents and in some situations some petitioners, given the facts, are in a position to manipulate the process. And as it is now, an individual who is served with a restraining order and who does not want to come under the coverage of the federal law, yes, you're absolutely correct. They can avoid that coverage by not requesting a hearing.
So my follow-up question to that is, if we don't implement this bill because of the fiscal, and we know that this is going on, do you have another alternative way to avoid that from happening?
Chairman, Senator Walker, the short answer is no, I don't.
I thought that would be your answer. Thank you for being honest.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. All right. I think Brian DeLashmet and Liz Crothers from OCPA want to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be relatively brief. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and I think what you're going to hear from us today is slightly different than what we initially came into this committee to say. Given the discussion, I'll let Liz give you some comments, and I've got a couple suggestions for the bills, actually both bills.
All right, thank you. Liz?
Yeah, my name is Liz Crothers. I'm a police officer, and I'm also the vice president of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. We are here today in complete opposition to Senate Bill 49, Senate Bill 300 is somewhat more palatable to the OCPA in that it does at least refer to the federal exemption having to do with law enforcement officers being able to carry their gun while on duty. But our concern is that we want to ensure that this bill does, in fact, incorporate that federal exemption, and I think Brian can explain a little bit as to why we may not be convinced that it does contain that federal exemption. If 300 does not contain the federal exemption, we are convinced that this will cost police officers their jobs. And we don't think that it's fair to treat police officers differently than any other occupation as it relates to restraining orders. And we have so far heard no evidence to indicate that we need to be treating police officers differently than other occupations. And I just want to explain a little bit, too, that if this exemption is not put into this bill and a police officer is fired as a result, what's going to happen is that you're going to hurt the very people that you're trying to protect. In other words, if an officer is unemployed, how would they pay child support? So we don't think that it's fair to punish the families as well when we're really trying to protect them. In addition, we are concerned, neither one of these bills address this issue, but we are also concerned for our members who may have domestic problems at home. For example, they might be going through a bitter divorce. We're concerned that this may be a tool, especially if it's not fixed, to somehow further injure a person going through a bitter divorce. For example, if I'm upset at my husband and he's a police officer, I could use this as a tool to be vindictive to my husband and potentially cost him his job. So we're a little bit concerned about the potential abuse of the system, especially if the federal exemption is not in place.
Mr. Chair, if I...
Before we move on, don't you think there's some protection? In fact, you talked about families suffering for lack of child support potentially, but it's actually the victim who would have to request the hearing under 300. I mean, do you think that there would be a disincentive for abuse because that very same victim would be the one who would be cut off from a job potentially if the federal law did not apply?
I don't think so.
Actually, Senator Burdick, I'm confused by your term use of the victim. Are you talking about the respondent?
Respondent, yes.
Yeah, because I think that's confusing. I mean, I got the impression when you're talking about the victim, and it's really the respondent's ability.
No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. No, I meant the petitioner.
Okay.
Because in the bill, I mean, if it were in... Right now, under 300, there is protection for law enforcement officers on the job. But even if that were gone, in a domestic violence situation, under the framework of 300, the petitioner would be able to request the hearing. Don't you think there's some protection in the fact that if the petitioner faced the loss of the job potentially, that the petitioner would be the one who would face the loss of child support payments? I mean, you were saying they'd lose child support, et cetera, but they're the ones that would have to start the process.
I think you mean respondent.
Again, I'm confused on whether you really mean respondent or whether you're talking about the petitioner by asking for a hearing, in
right.
fact, then submits to the potential problem of not being able to get child support from
That's
the respondent.
That's what I'm saying.
I understand that argument. I think maybe I can clarify by just giving you a couple suggestions. One is we have been shown, and I was aware that there is federal law, and there's an exception under federal statute to this. In reading both bills, it was real clear to me that 49 did not have that protection, and 300 it was unclear until I talked to some attorneys ahead of time. My suggestion would be in both cases that at the very least there be a specific phrase that would go something like, nothing in this act shall abridge the right of a public safety officer to avail themselves of the exceptions under the federal statute. I think that makes us much more comfortable. And the other piece that, as I was listening to the testimony, that would make me a little more comfortable is clarification that in the time period between the ex parte hearing and the actual hearing requested by either the petitioner or the respondent, that in fact a public safety officer still has the ability to use those possession and use the weapon as it relates to work situations. I want to be very, very clear with the committee and the members in the audience. The Oregon Council of Police Associations
does not believe in domestic violence or abuse, and our initial reactions to both these bills was as it relates to the job situation and the ability for a police officer to possess a weapon while on the job.
Senator Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused because when you came up here at the dais, you said you're strongly opposed to these bills, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, they don't like these bills.
Senator Walker, actually, I think the statement was strongly opposed 49, because 49 does not possess any language dealing with the federal exception.
Okay, but that's okay to strongly oppose the bill because it doesn't have that provision, but can you support the bill if that provision is put in there? I mean, I didn't get that from your body language and your conversation that you'd support 49 with that provision.
Senator Walker, my opening statement was, in fact, the testimony that we were getting was different than what you probably would have heard without suggestion of this additional language. I think the reaction of the police officers in both bills was specific around that one issue of the job. If that can be taken care of, then our position is likely to be modified.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm just not very good at my note-taking this morning, but I just got this strange feeling from you. And if we can handle that, then I understand your position.
You have to understand, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, this whole issue of police officers, when the federal statute was going through, was a very long discussion, was an issue about the ability for police officers to do their jobs, at the, and that discussion did occur at the federal level. So when the officers saw these two bills and could not make a specific reference between 49, it does not exist, and 300, I'm told it does exist in the bill, but I'd like to have it a little bit clearer.
Okay.
They read both bills and said, listen, this has already been fought at the federal level. We don't see exception here. This causes us major concern.
One other question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand what you're talking about, Mr. DeLashmet. Could you please tell me, since you've had a great deal of discussion about this with the federal law, does the exemption work so that if we do have a law enforcement officer who has been accused of domestic violence with a weapon, they get to use their weapon at work, has this bill... has this exemption protected a domestic violence victim from
actually,
shot?
Actually, Senator Walker, I have two responses. One is I don't think either one of these bills says domestic violence using a weapon. It's an abuse situation and does not have to include abuse using a weapon. So that's the one clarification. But as far as the federal statute, I'm not aware enough of the long enough history on the federal statute to know whether or not it, in fact, has worked or hasn't worked. I'm not aware of situations in which police officers, because of the federal statute, have been dispossessed or, in fact, still have the weapons and have used them in any manner that that they shouldn't be using them.
Okay.
All right. No other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony. I want to ask now if there's any person who's signed up to testify who cannot come back on Wednesday at 8 in the morning. All right. So those two individuals who could not. Your name, sir?
Lee Anderson.
Why don't you come up and, sir, your name?
Roy Sutton.
Do you want to come up also or come up after Mr. Anderson? Good morning, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Lee Anderson. I'm the founder and director of Portland Firearms Training Team. And it's clear that we have something in common, everybody in this room. And that is that on average, 10 women a year in Oregon are shot and killed by a thug who is a current or ex-intimate partner of the victim. That's a problem. One is a problem. The solution that seems to be offered here seems to me very clumsy and very unwieldy and awkward, in which we are going to seize the private property and infringe on the constitutional rights of tens of thousands of people in order to find those 10 thugs. While we have lots of problems of how do we know where the guns are, how do we know who has them, and how do we know if we have actually disarmed the right needle in the haystack. The fundamental flaw is to believe that if you take the thug's gun away, you have disarmed him and rendered him harmless. I think that's, even if we pass all this, the problem is the complacency that comes from believing that the woman is now safe, that we have protected her by writing laws in Salem. So we've taken the revolutionary step of changing the perspective. Instead of addressing a universe of objects and people outside, we have taken the point of view of the woman herself. Women Empowered for Defense is a 9-hour long introduction to the mental planning, the mental awareness, the mindset that is required for self-defense. She is ultimately responsible for her own defense. In addition, we teach her how to shoot a handgun. And we have trained more than 250 women in the last 9 months in this program. There are two dramatic things that I have learned in the last 9 months. One of them is that it is possible to teach almost any woman how to handle a handgun safely and how to use it effectively in 9 hours. The other astonishing thing is the response that we've had from women who tell us universally that the system is broken, it does not protect them, and they are eager for this. We offered a class for 30 people at Canby Rod and Gun Club in September, and we had 209 women sign up for it. I urge you to fund a pilot program, perhaps in Multnomah County, where we can actually put this to the test. Let's find out. It's a change of perspective, and I know I've seen some shocked looks. An armed self-defense is not only legal, it can be very, very effective. We are addressing those people at risk, and we are empowering them. We're putting the tools in their minds and in their hands that they need to defend themselves. And it's going to work a lot better than rooting around out there writing laws and thinking that we have now protected them.
So, thank you, Mr. Anderson. If I understand correctly, you would not have us pass these laws, which are merely tools. What would, again, be your methodology for dealing with the problem?
Well, I think that we should do a pilot program. One of the things it's going to take is a changing of attitude. I think that a lot of the domestic violence professionals have been doing this a long time, and the wisdom is inherited, and the wisdom is old and tired, and it's not working.
What's your substitution for that? That's what I'm trying to get to.
Firearms training. Oh, mental and firearms training.
So we have women's strength classes, I think, in the Portland Police Bureau.
The Portland Police Bureau, yes.
Women to do domestic or to do self-defense.
Right.
Is that something you're suggesting, or is it firearms?
Well, what I've seen is that women don't like to go to the police department for protection because they don't trust the police department to protect them. That privately offered. And it's not just handguns. We have, we give them a lot of preliminary stuff about mindset and responsibility and safety. No one of our 250 graduates would leave a loaded handgun around in a house full of children, for instance. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would encourage some empowerment for the woman to defend herself.
All right. So you're suggesting more training for women with respect to the use of firearms?
I am.
Mental preparedness to defend themselves, et cetera.
So that they have in their possession, in their immediate universe, a means for self-defense.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Would you consider that to be a fair fight, or would you wait till the husband goes to sleep and you beat him over the head with a brick?
Well, no, we don't encourage this in an ongoing dysfunctional relationship. This should come in after the separation, after the court orders. It's one of the most dangerous times for victims of domestic violence is when they're finally just about out of reach.
All right. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. The other gentleman. What is your name, sir?
Roy Sutton.
Okay. Thank you, Roy.
I'm not a real formal person. I'll address you as ladies and gentlemen.
You can tell I'm not too formal either.
Okay. I'm against these bills. I haven't got to read them in their entirety, but what I came here to do is to more or less tell you I'm a victim of the current bill, current laws that you have on the books. And I say victim because I haven't been charged with a crime, I haven't been tried for a crime, and I haven't been found guilty of a crime. I simply went through a divorce, and my wife asked for a restraining order. She got it. Domestic violence was, I was accused of it. And she got the restraining order, thus I got the order saying I couldn't possess firearms. Now, I'd like to say right out of the gate, there had never been an accusation of domestic violence or anything occurred until she went down and asked for the restraining order. It was after the fact that she went down and filed her so-called first report. And when this report was made, they were rejected by the police department and by the DA's office immediately. But that didn't protect me either. I chose to, and I called several attorneys. I asked for advice. Couldn't get the same advice from any two attorneys on the ramifications of responding to the restraining order. Common sense kind of told me, hey, it's not the truth, it's a lie, I'm going to respond. I want my day in court. What you guys are talking about in some of this is contrary. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You're hung either way. And you're even taking a greater risk if you even respond to it. You go to court, you want your day in court, hey, hang them high. If in fact, the judge decides to go along with this. The day of my trial, and I noticed the judge left, and I noticed that she's from Multnomah County. I wish she was still here.
Well, the day of your trial or the day of the contested case here? The day of the contested case, the restraining order hearing.
That was in October of 2001.
Okay, I just want to make sure what we're talking about.
Well, it was, she asked for the restraining order in October of 2001. I responded the following month.
Right, but you said trial, and that inferred to me that you're...
Well, they're saying that it's like a trial. I wasn't charged. I'm referring to
right.
the...
But you weren't charged with a criminal...
No, sir.
Charge.
No, sir. Never been charged with a crime of any kind right. in my life.
All right.
The day of the hearing got there, we was foretold the judge was going to let us have 20 minutes. They deal with three restraining orders an hour. Per hour. So you're given this little old summary hearing in there, and in my first hearing, her attorney ate up most of the time. By the time we got to my end of the where I was going to offer my explanation and my defense, I did not get to present one witness, not one. Mine sat out in the hallway and waited. I left. I didn't get to put on my case at all. Judge said I heard enough. No evidence. No police reports, no nothing. He said, she said. Based on that, I had my constitutional rights taken away from me. Stripped there. I own 120 acres out here. I ranch for a living. I got deer, elk, animals in my yard, wolves, or not wolves, coyotes, mountain lion, you name it. Guns have been a way of life for me. They've been there since day one. Never used a gun for anything other than what I had to in the course of a day of work, or I like to hunt and fish and so forth. But yet, here I sit today, being treated like I'm a felon, a criminal, and I haven't broke one law, I haven't been tried for one law, nothing. And yet, these people are so anxious to jump on the wagon and go to yanking away your gun rights because they've now attached this anti-gun movement to this domestic violence thing. Furthermore, the thing that's really kind of cute here is the day after she requested the restraining order, which was October the 12th, the following day she drove out 80 miles to where I was at. She then committed four crimes, which she's currently awaiting trial on. Vehicular assault, personal assault on myself and one other person. When I brought and now in the course in the meantime, we're waiting for this to go to trial. She asked for, guess what? An extension. Great. This works wonderful, people. To get this extension, the only thing she has to do and had to do, we just say, gee, I woke up this morning, I had a tear in my eyes, it's his fault, and I want an extension. She got it. No contact between us. Nothing else, nothing had occurred, no more accusations other than she wanted this thing to be continued. She understands the impact it has on my life. She knows what it's done to me. at the end of the hearing, and Judge Waller, she gave us a good hearing. She complimented me on my case, but she told me in the end that the threshold needed to get an extension was so low that merely by asking, she got it. We went through an hour and 20 minutes of a hearing for no reason whatsoever. That was her words at the end of the hearing. She asked for it, she gives it. That simple. Now, you know, I got to ask you.
When did that occur?
This was just last month before. See, this is what?
Can you give me just the date of the hearing and which court it was in?
Let's see here. I've got the paper in here. Sorry. One 8 of 03.
Which courtroom or courthouse?
Yeah, Nan Waller.
Which county?
Multnomah County.
Multnomah County. Okay.
Yeah, during the course of the trial, of course, she had alleged somebody had poisoned her rabbit and a bird. These birds were, just had an old bird out there. The witness that waited out in the hallway, she alleged I poisoned them. I asked her if she filed a police report. No. You take the animals to a vet, get a report on it? No. Then the witness comes in. Well, the witness testifies that the rabbit and the bird had been disemboweled, not poisoned, disemboweled. They contradicted each other. There wasn't a thing I could say in that courtroom that was going to quash that restraining or the continuance of it. Nothing. The threshold is too low here. It's just too low. I'm not a criminal. I've never been a criminal. I don't intend to be a criminal. That's why I'm here today. Obviously, I believe in going through the system. I'm just somebody that works for a living out here. I believe in my constitutional rights. Guns happen to be a part of my life. They've always been a part of them. And I don't want that to change, though it has. The fearful part here is, for me, is that apparently she can come in year after year after year and ask for one of these extensions and get it. As I said, she's currently being prosecuted in Linn County. Her new trial date, as these good defense attorneys are so good at getting these things put off way down the road, they've done it. Her next trial date's June the 3rd, where she'll be tried. But, you know, this, if you look at the picture of this whole thing, this is a case of abuse. The system has been manipulated. And she, and thus far, has gotten away with it. In the meantime, I'm asked to wait in the wings here. And apparently, because I requested the first hearing, it's even felt that because I contested the first restraining order and it failed, I cannot own a firearm the rest of my life under federal law. I've gotten conflicting information on that as to whether that's a fact or not. Again, I don't understand this. I don't understand how this came to be. She's an alcoholic. We've had problems. I've never denied it. She continues to have problems. But we are divorced. I've moved on. I want to go on with my life. I want to go on with all my life. In its entirety. Not just a little bits and pieces. It's lawmakers and other people decide I'm entitled to have. I think that these constitutional protections that we all enjoy are just too important to us to let some judge in some courtroom in some county with some half-baked hearing where you don't even have a chance to call your witnesses, where they say they're on a time schedule, willy-nilly go through this and then go yanking away people's constitutional rights. I don't know how that can fly. I just don't understand it. And I'd like to make a kind of an analogy here. We're really anxious, it seems, and I know there's a big deal here about guns. And, you know, people should be held responsible for violence, like whether it's with a gun, a stick, or whatever. I agree with that. I have no qualms with it. But this has turned into a witch hunt for gun owners, is what this is to me. This is exactly what this has turned into. Any way we can, any way possible to attach any infraction of the law, let's go for the guns. And at the same time, we've had drunk drivers out here killing people for how long? My neighbor can't call up and say, hey, oh, Joe, there, he's a drunkard, he drinks. And I don't want him to have a driver's license. I don't want him behind that wheel. Those people have to be stopped. They have to be tried and convicted before you yank away their driver's license, which is only a state privilege. It's only a state privilege. And you protect that. But yet, whenever it comes to our constitutional rights, oh, we're just leaping off the balconies to yank those away from people. Because of what? The gun owners. Gun owners. We've got to get the gun owners. We've got to.
All right, Mr. Sutton, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? The time is now past our normal closing time. I appreciate the comments that you made. Hopefully we'll get the record. I want to get the record of your particular case and see if we can...
Were you talking to me?
Well, I'm just saying we're going to try to get the record for your case and listen to it.
Please
see what
do.
You do. All right. Thank you very much. All right. Appreciate it. With that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn.